Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today for another edition of Garden Talk. We're going to be talking with Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent. And Sharon, it's a pleasure to have you back at the telephone with us today.
Well, it's always a pleasure for me, too, and happy spring to you.
Happy spring to you, although if you go outside today, it may seem like it's slow to arrive.
Except the grass is green, and to me that's always the first sign of spring, really.
Well, let's pick up on that. Somebody walks outside their home and looks around and says, I should be doing something with this lawn.
And there are a few things that they can do, but maybe not what most people think. The first thing people think of is fertilizing, I think, and weed control. And if you've had crabgrass as a problem in years past, you may want to try and prevent that crabgrass seed from germinating this year by using a crabgrass preventer. But we recommend waiting until the end of May to do your first fertilizer application. So if you can get a product that's just the crabgrass preventer, that may be helpful. If you did not fertilize your lawn last fall, however, you can fertilize now. A light fertilizer application along with that crabgrass preventer is an option.
Mm-hmm.
Another product to use for crabgrass prevention and other weed seed prevention in the lawn is corn gluten meal. It has become popular because it is a natural plant product. It's a byproduct of corn processing. And it also contains 9% nitrogen. It does inhibit the growth of some seeds, weed seeds, and turf grass seeds, too. So you can't reseed those bare spots and then put any of the preventers down. But it can take a few years to build up in your soil and in your yard, so you won't get 100% control the first year you use it. But it is a nice organic solution for people who don't want to use a commercial pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
What you should be doing is raking, looking for those bare spots in your yard to reseed, and working out some of those vole runs, meadow mice or voles are the little mice that run around in your lawn, especially longer, lusher lawns through the winter. And then when the snow melts, the first thing you see are these crazy quilt patterns of these little tunnels all over. Nothing you need to do for those except rake them out. So this would be a good time to be doing that.
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation with Sharon Morrissey, all you have to do is pick up the telephone at 263-1890 in Madison or toll-free at 800-642-1234. And just mentioned that after the noon news, we will be talking with one of the co-authors of a new book from Burby, The Complete Flower Gardener, The Comprehensive Guide to Growing Flowers Organically. Have you seen that book yet, Sharon?
No, I haven't, and I'm just making a note of it right now. It sounds fascinating. I'd love to hear what she has to say.
It's a book that you can do exercises with. That inclusive.
Hefty.
Yes, hefty and inclusive. And it's really a fine book. We'll be talking with one of the co-authors afternoon. But we'll take your calls. By the way, has anything changed in regard to the ash tree borer that's making its way towards the state?
Well, as far as whether it's been identified here and found here in Wisconsin, no, not to my knowledge.
Okay.
And that would be big news all over the state if it had been. And so we're still out looking for it, and the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, DATCAP, has been busy with its detection tree program, and so they have been scouting for it for a couple of years. So everybody needs to be on the lookout. Everybody needs to know what the symptoms are. There has been a slight change there's still a lot of discussion about the control measures that are going to be implemented once it's found, and if there should be some preventative control done or not. Because this is a new pest, all of the research information coming in is new, and we keep adding to that information and changing our strategies accordingly.
So I didn't know that there was a control that could possibly keep that tree from falling prey to the borer, but I've seen television commercials that are advertising complete protection for existing ash trees with a product that goes into the root system, another product that goes on the canopy overhead. Your thoughts about that?
Well, there are several products out there that have been labeled for control of emerald ash borer. There has been some success with the use of those products. There are a couple of considerations. One is that it depends on the approach that will be taken when emerald ash borer is found in the state of Wisconsin. Trees that have been treated may be left standing and may be allowed to continue to exist. Others may, in other cases, they may cut those down too.
Mm-hmm.
So the treatment then would have been all for naught. And at this point, I know that that working group of scientists from several states and several agencies is not currently recommending preventative treatment. The other consideration is that these preventative treatments aren't always 100% effective, and if the ash borer is already in the tree, then those treatments too may be for naught.
Right.
So there are still a lot of questions and a lot of variables to consider. And as I say, we are not at this point recommending preventative treatments. But stay tuned. As I say, they're considering all of the results of the research that keeps coming in.
Our guest is Sharon Morrissey. She's the Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent, and we'll take some calls. We've got a couple of lines open if you have a question at 263-1890 in Madison or toll-free at 800-642-1234. John leads us off. John's in Mount Horeb. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Every year I start plants as soon as possible for my vegetable garden. And I already feel like I'm a little behind this year and might not have time to do everything I normally do, like broccoli and cabbage. And I'd like to know which ones should a person really start inside early and which ones can go directly in the garden if you're not eager in getting that harvest a few weeks earlier. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. That's a really good question because there are some plants that should be transplanted as small plants into the garden, so they do need to be started indoors first, or you can wait and purchase them at your local garden center. Other plants can be, or other crops can be started from seed very easily in the garden, and it's about the second to third week in April that you can start seeds directly for over a dozen vegetable crops. So a big chunk of the garden can be started outdoors, and that includes a lot of the early spring crops that are very short growing season and very cool temperature loving, things like radishes and lettuce and carrots, beets, chard, parsley, onion sets, parsnips, kohlrabi, I'm thinking of the list now, spinach, that's a great one to start very early in the season. So there's a whole list of them. There is an extension publication, of course, The Vegetable Garden it's called, and I believe it's publication A1839. I'll have to check on that. But it is a publication that in the back has a listing of all the vegetable crops in alphabetical order and tells you when you can start them outdoors by seed and when you need to start them indoors if they do need to be started indoors before the season. Now, broccoli and cauliflower and the early cabbage are the ones that, what some of the ones, and also tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants, that can be started middle of March or a little later. So you're really not too late on those that you start indoors. You may just be transplanting slightly smaller plants, but that's okay. Because if you start in too early indoors, then those crops that can't, like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, can't go out until 8 weeks from now, you're going to have to provide great conditions for them to grow indoors before you can take them out. And the longer you have to do that, the more potential there is that those plants won't be in great shape by the time they get out in the ground. So you're really not too late to even start some things indoors.
John, good luck to you, and hope your garden turns out satisfactory for you this year. Let's go to Doris next in Shawnee County. Doris, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to know a little about composting. Why aren't you supposed to put potato sprouts in? Is it okay if you would cut them up short, or is there something chemical about them?
I have never heard that, to not put potato sprouts in a compost pile.
Oh,
I don't think there's any concern with those. And if I'm wrong, and if there's a listener who knows of something else, but in our master composter training and in the publications that we distribute, I've never seen that.
Mm-hmm. And what about coffee grounds? Is it better to put them in the compost or just sprinkle them over the ground?
Well, coffee grounds, provide nitrogen. They're a source of nitrogen. And so when you add them to a compost pile, you see them as one of the green materials. Even though they're brown in color, because they provide nitrogen, they're considered a green material in your compost pile. If you mix them in with your compost, that's good because oftentimes you have a lot of brown in your compost, which is the dry, harder to break down things like leaves, dry leaves, especially over the winter. And then in the spring, adding some of the coffee grounds is a good way to get some nitrogen going in that compost pile. It really probably is six and one half dozen of the other, whether you put them in your compost pile or you put them directly into the ground. If you're putting them onto the soil, work them into the soil, you're adding some organic matter, but there's and some nitrogen, but there's not a huge advantage to using coffee grounds either way. If it's just a way to recycle a resource, an organic resource, then you can do it either way.
Mm-hmm. Another thing. I have lichens growing on gravestones. Is there what chemical or what? How could I get rid of that?
Boy, I do not know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know the answer on that one either.
Because lichens are actually on growing on plants, they're not causing any problem. But I can understand where you wouldn't want them on gravestones or even on other things that are sitting outside. And I don't know how to remove them because I've never had to do that.
Okay.
All right,
you.
Doris, thank you very much. Good luck to you. And let's go on next to Don in Fenimore. Don, what's on your mind?
Well, number one, I guess I've used bleach to get the lichens off on gravestones, and it seems to work and hold them off for a while.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Number one. And number two, I was just wondering about the benefits of agricultural lime on your yard, on the grass, you know?
Yeah, it depends on what part of the state you're in. I see you're in Fenimore. That unfortunately doesn't mean a whole lot to me. But from a soil test, you would determine what your pH of your soil is. And agricultural lime would add, it would lift the pH. That means it would raise the pH if it is low in pH. And so it depends on what part of the state you're in and what kind of soil you have and what the pH of the soil is. If you have a very low pH, then lime is sometimes recommended for your lawn, but I would go by the recommendations of a soil test before using lime on your soil.
Thank you. I've also heard that it chases or drives the moles away. Do you have any idea of that? Keeps the grubs away or whatever?
No, unfortunately, that is not, I don't think that's a scientific fact.
Okay.
It would be nice if it would be something that you're already doing to your lawn that would provide for some control.
Right.
Control for moles and things, but I'm afraid that isn't the case. Not that easy.
Don, thank you very much for your call. You brought up soil test, and as a general rule of advice for gardeners, this is a good time for the soil test, is it not?
Yes, it is. It's a great time to do it. Now, the soils lab is going to be getting busy because everybody is doing it, but it is a great time to do a soil test so that you can determine what you need to do to your soil as you're getting started with the growing season.
Don, thank you very much for your call. Our guest is Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent, and this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Jim Packard with Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent, and we're answering your gardening questions today. If you have a question or a comment, the number at Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Sharon, let's go back to the phones, and Steve is next in La Crosse. Steve, what can we do for you?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got a problem with my lawn. I first started noticing last summer. I've got about an acre and a half in a rural area, and I've been noticing more and more, like you mentioned earlier, the trails of for like mice or voles.
Mm-hmm.
And some also tunnels, and it's getting to be just a lot of them all over the lawn. And I'm not sure exactly what it is. I've never seen them or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, Well, there are actually a couple of things that can cause that, and there are some distinctions among the kinds of activity that they do, and so there are certain things to look for with each different type of critter that could be doing that. The meadow mice and voles that we talked about earlier, they don't really tunnel underground. They simply make trails in the grass right down at the soil surface, kind of in that thickened part just before you get to the soil. It's not really a thatch layer. It's the stems and sheaths of the grass that have been sloughed. Kind of in that area, they'll just kind of work their way through that. So it's a very much a surface type of tunnel. They are about the size of your standard mouse, but they're a little bit larger than that, so that gives you an idea what size and width those little trails would be. They're more trails than tunnels. Moles, on the other hand, they're at kind of the opposite extreme, and those are quite a bit larger. They do tunnel underground, and they do push up a raised mound for the entire length of the tunnel. So wherever they've been tunneling, you'll have a raised soil and sod or dirt or a lawn, and that will be a real good indication that they're moles. There are pocket gophers are another one, and I believe there are some chipmunks, too, that do some tunneling. And I don't have right on the tip of my tongue which does which, but they have one of them has certain size holes and leaves a mound of dirt outside the entrance or exit to their tunnels. The other one does not. So those are the kinds of things to look for. There are several very good publications through Extension on all of these critters and gives their biology and all of their habits and tells you about the types of symptoms to look for. I'd suggest that you go to our publications website and look if it's not the tunneling in the grass at the soil surface, which would be voles, and if it's not the mounded soil, which would be moles. Then, if it is voles, let's say, meadow mice do that tunneling in lush grass and in areas that have had a lot of vegetation left around the base of trees. So one way to help to reduce that trail-making activity during the winter under the snow is prior to winter, for the very last mowing of the year, to mow your lawn shorter by at least a half inch, if not more, so that you don't have nice, long, lush grass for them to tunnel in once the snow has covered up the lawn.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, and I've got moles, and I know this is something that's smaller than that. And also, there's some, I don't know if it'd be a raccoon or something, that you can see where they're digging these tunnels up and at night, and evidently trying to get at these critters to eat them.
Yeah. Either that, or they're going for some of the grubs that are down under the turf, and then they try and eat the grubs. But if you've got tunneling combined with it, it may be that it's something going after the critter itself. And like I suggest, going to the publications website for UW Extension.
And that's CE Commerce?
Actually, there's an easier website for that now. It's the Learning Store, just LEARNINGSTORE, learningstore.uwex.edu.
All right. Good luck, Steve.
Yeah, Thank you. Good luck with that.
Appreciate your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890 or 800-642-1234, our toll-free number. And we go to Brian in Milwaukee next. Hello, Brian.
Hi, good morning. My question pertains to geraniums. Throughout the summer, I've got potted geraniums in my yard. Come fall, I bring the pots inside, keep them in sunlight, and they keep growing throughout the winter.
Mm-hmm.
What I end up doing is usually around January, I'll cut the plants down and I cut off a couple inches of the green stem with the leaves, put them in water in cups, keep them in the sun. They produce a real nice root system, and then I transplant them.
Mm-hmm.
What I did was I potted them last week. And my problem is usually from this point forward until summer when I take them outside. What I'm worried about is now that I've got them in some nice loamy soil and pots, how often should I be watering them? Obviously, the roots are growing in the water during the winter, but now I'm worried about maybe a mold problem or whatever. And the second part of my problem is when I do take them outside, usually around Memorial Day weekend, sometimes I'll lose up to about half of my plants. And prior to that, they're just flourishing inside. You got any pointers for me to kind of complete my task? Because, you know, the first half of what I do is really quite successful.
Yeah.
The second half comes with mixed results.
Right. And there probably are a couple of reasons for that, and maybe we can discuss some of that. As far as when you, how often you water them and concerns with rotting or mold, you don't want to keep the soil so wet that it's constantly wet because that will encourage mold growth and rot off those roots. When you root the cuttings, you're rooting them in water. And the roots that form in water, because there's very little resistance for those roots, are usually kind of flimsy. And because they don't need to bulk up to get through the soil. Then you pot them up into soil, and they do all right for a while, but they would be more sensitive to rotting and any kind of damage from potting them up. It may be better to root those cuttings in a nice, very airy, well-drained mixture of, say, vermiculite and perlite mixed together. And let that be your rooting medium that you keep quite moist, constantly moist. Let the roots form in that, and then you'll have a stronger root system going into the soil that you pot them up into before you put them outside. So that may be one thing that'll help a little bit, getting a little bit more sturdy root system before you pot them up. The second thing might be in hardening them off and getting them ready to go outside. Do you just simply take them from inside one day to outside the next day and then leave them there?
Usually, yes. I'll put them outside, and then I'll try to bring them in at night. But I'll tell you what, if I happen to go away for a couple hours or whatever, and it turns out to be a little bit hotter of a day than I thought it would be, that seems to, I don't know, that's it, you know?
Well, and that could be combined with this kind of weaker root system, too. If it gets too hot, there's more demand on the root system for moisture, and it may just be too wimpy a root system to provide that moisture. So by getting a stronger root system, that could help with that, too. But that acclimating process, it's called hardening off, of plants that are grown indoors and then moved outdoors is real important. Even if you're moving them outdoors when the conditions are good for that plant to normally grow, you should do it gradually, introduce them to that gradually, by putting them in a kind of a shady spot where there's not a lot of wind for a while. And then gradually move them for a short period of time each day out into conditions that are more stressful, like fuller sun, more wind that will dry them out more. And do that for maybe a period of a couple of weeks before you put them into full sun all day long in a, you know, exposed windy site. So those are some suggestions that I have for you to maybe improve the practices a little bit, but it sounds like you've got quite a production going there, and with a couple of tweaks, you'll probably be quite successful.
Yeah, everything seems to be working quite well. What are your thoughts on a little bit of muriacid in water, a little liquid fertilizer from time to time?
Well, it doesn't need to be liquid fertilizer. Once the roots have developed, then those roots can take up fertilizer. Once new growth is being formed, some fertilizer would be helpful. They'll be able to use that fertilizer. And once the growing conditions are really good, so, you know, once you've potted them up, you could probably start fertilizing them. Just like with most houseplants, any houseplant fertilizer, maybe a quarter strength at first and only every couple of waterings. And with the watering, don't keep them too wet. Make sure you've got a well, moist, well-drained soil. Don't let the pot that the plants are growing in sit in water and soak that water back up constantly, because then there's no air in the pores between the soil particles, and the plant literally suffocates.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Good luck to you. We appreciate hearing from you. And our next caller is Mark in Eau Claire. And, Mark, what can we do for you?
I got a gardening question. I have a rear tine tiller that goes on my garden tractor that I use to till up my garden in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told, not by horticulturists, but a bunch of friends of mine, that that's not good for the ground, that it beats it up too much. And it does pulverize it really nicely. I mean, it aerates it, and, you know, when it does rain, it soaks in nicely. And and my other question is, there's an area, half of my garden that I had had disked up, and I noticed in the last couple years that in the spring, it has a moss-looking spots covered, you know, over the top of the ground.
Okay, well, let me address the first question with the rear tine tiller. I don't think it really matters that much whether it's rear tine, forward tine. It, what matters is how thoroughly you go over one area, or if you go over areas multiple times. If you go over it multiple times, or you go very, very slowly and it's rotating the entire time, you could break down the soil to the point where the structure actually is affected. So although it's nice and light and fluffy, you have kind of broken it down to smaller aggregates, they call them. They're clumps of soil that don't reform real well if you've over-tilled. So going over it lightly once. Now, that doesn't mean don't go deep, because going deep is helpful, but just don't go over it very slowly and over and over and over again. Okay.
Yeah, I plant my rows of, well, 4.5 feet, so that my garden tractor can go in between, and it's offset, so I can get real close to the plants for weeding purposes. And so I would be going over and over to the summer, you know, whenever I see them come up.
Yeah. Well, maybe using the tiller to do your cultivation, bring the tiller up so it's only going an inch deep. Maybe you don't need to go real deep to do cultivation. And that may help to prevent from breaking down the structure of the soil too much. Another thing you might want to try is do fall tilling instead of spring tilling. That would be a very rough tilling where you go over it rather quickly, working in organic matter that has been on the surface of the soil for the growing season. And disking does the same thing, because it just kind of roughly breaks up, tills up, lightens up the soil. Then over the winter, the moisture in the soil freezes and thaws, and kind of breaks it down, settles it, and then by spring, you're ready to just very lightly go over it, if at all, and then plant directly into it. With the disking and the mold on the soil, or the moss growing on the soil, I don't think the two are related unless it's a very moist area where it's shady. And moss really only grows in shady spots. So I don't know what's growing there. If it's a vegetable garden, I presume it's not in the shade. And if it's a wet area, you're probably doing some damage to the soil at the same time. So I just, unusual, I guess, to have a mold or something growing on exposed soil.
Yeah, it's in wide open area. There's no shade there at all at any part of the time of the day. So
you may want to take a sample of that into your county extension office.
There's the answer right there, Mark.
I can do.
Mark, thank you very much for your call. Good luck to you. And let's go next to, let's see here. Let's go to Al in Two Harbors, Minnesota. And Al, what's on your mind today?
Well, I listen to your show all the time, and a few weeks ago you had a guest on who talked about those of us that put our wood ashes on the garden for the winter, and it was the wrong thing to do. And I'm wondering if there is some kind of a fertilizer that I can, because I've been doing that right along actually for years, and I wondered if there's some kind of fertilizer that I can put in there to counteract that. And was the other guest right?
We don't recommend using a lot of wood ash. And if you really are producing a lot of wood ash over the winter and you're putting it all into a garden area, it would have to be a very large garden area to accommodate it all. There is a kind of a ratio of how much per 100 square feet, and I don't remember that right off the top of my head. It is in one of our info source messages, and you can get those online. And I'll give the web address for that in a second. But the reason for not using wood ash is that it contains a lot of potassium, first of all. And second of all, it also raises the pH quite a bit. And so it depends on what the pH of your soil starts as. And in the southeastern corner of Wisconsin, we have very high pH soils already. And then you add wood ash, and it makes it even worse. So I would check your soil and have it tested for both potassium and the pH. And the standard garden soil test will do that for you, will tell you that. The high potassium levels can be very difficult on young roots, on tender new roots of seedlings and transplants. So you don't want to get potassium levels too high. And once again, in southeastern Wisconsin, we already have high potassium levels. And then if you add to that, you're compounding the problem there as well. So that's why we don't recommend using a lot of wood ash. A little bit okay, but generally if you burn wood throughout the winter, you're producing more than you should be putting into your standard home garden. Now, what can you do to counteract that? Nothing I know of. Time. Just time to break it down. Potassium doesn't really wash through the soil. It's not soluble. So it takes time for that to break down, be used up by plants, etc. And I don't know of anything that you can use to counteract that. But I would have a soil test done. And you can probably do that through your local extension office. And you'll find out about the pH, the potassium levels, and then you may want to talk with your soils lab about ways to counteract high levels of both of those.
Should I do that? Because the stuff is laying on top of the ground right now, and it's still frozen here. Should I do that after I till? Did the soil test?
Well, that's a very good question. If you till, you're going to be tilling in even more. They would then have an idea of the state that it's currently in. If you don't till, is there a way you can get that off of there?
No, that's a terrible project.
Then if that's not going to happen, I'd till it in first so that you can get that accurate picture of what your soil is like to the soils lab for them to
analyze. The garden hasn't been bad. That's why I'm questioning this. But, you know, I mean, it's been successful. But
well,
the guy told us this a few weeks ago, and I thought,
Well, and she agrees with you, Al.
What's that?
go with the soil test.
All right.
Okay. Good luck to you, Al. Thanks very much
luck.
For the call. Our guest today on Garden Talk is Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And our next caller is Janet in Madison. Janet, what's on your mind?
Hi. In the fall, I usually put a couple extra bags of tulip and daffodil bulbs in my basement refrigerator drawers, and then as soon as my window boxes are workable and my pots, I plant them in there and enjoy them coming up, you know, with some other, I'll add some autumn joy sedum and, you know, iris and Siberian iris and regular iris and just odds and ends of, you know, extra things in my perennial gardens to just add some height and some interest. And I'm a teacher, so then in June when these things have petered out, I have a little more time to take them out, put them back in the garden or whatever, and then do my summer gardens or summer window boxes. But the problem last year particularly, and I'm sure this year, will be as soon as I get these bulbs in my seven window boxes and pots, the squirrels are busy trying to dig them out. And, you know, I'm just wondering how I can have those and my pansies and my other things in my window boxes without the squirrels. You know, is there something that I can do to deter the squirrels?
Well, there are a few things you can try. They're pretty persistent little guys, as you know. So I guess one approach would be, you'll probably have to combine approaches, and with wildlife, that generally is the case. One approach is an area repellent, where you apply a repellent to the window boxes so that that smell itself will keep them away. And you may need to reapply it and reapply it to repel them. Because it does get diluted, and they can also get accustomed to it over time. But that may be only partially effective. You can also cover the window boxes with hardware cloth, and that would be a mesh, wire mesh covering. There's also a plastic cloth mesh that they use to keep birds off of fruit crops and things. It's a much wider mesh. It's very light in texture, and you hardly notice that it's there. And you could probably put that over your window boxes, too. That may deter them from digging. But if they're very determined, they would go through that plastic mesh because it has pretty wide openings in it. Hardware cloth, the metal mesh, wire mesh, is probably going to be a better deterrent for squirrels. Now that I think about it, with squirrels, I don't think they have a sense of smell. I think that they have a sense of taste, but they don't have a sense of smell because they use hot pepper sprays and hot pepper flakes and things to prevent them from eating things, but they have to taste that first. So the area repellents that they smell aren't going to work, so I take that back. Just officially for the record. The other thing might be scare devices, you know, putting pie plates up and little whirly gigs, and then changing that around pretty frequently so they don't get used to it being any one way. But I think the thing that's, if anything's going to be successful, it'd be the Harper cloth or the wire mesh over the boxes and planters.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Janet. We appreciate your call. And let's see what's on Nancy's mind in Ashland. Hello, Nancy.
Hi. I'm calling about some lilac bushes that we have, and we've had them for about 5 years. The first year they bloomed a little bit. Then they did not bloom anymore for the last 5 years, and we have put, they said manure and lime. We did that in the fall. We pruned them, and they still did not bloom.
Okay. There are a couple of things that prevent lilacs from flowering. One of them is when the light conditions are too low, when it's too shady. Mm-hmm. So if they're in full sun, full day's worth of sun, all season long, then that's probably not what's doing it. But if they're in partial sun, it may just not be enough light for them to produce their flower buds. They'd flower the first year because those flower buds were probably formed before you purchased the plant and planted it, or plants and planted them. So if it's not that it's too shady, another thing that will prevent flowering is too much nitrogen fertilizer. Now, by applying it in the fall and applying it as manure, which is an organic and therefore slow-release fertilizer, you probably aren't applying too much nitrogen unless you're applying a lot of manure every fall. I wouldn't have expected that to affect it, though, the very first year that you did this and then didn't have any flowers afterwards. But nitrogen fertilizer can stimulate lots of leafy growth and prevent flowering.
Okay.
Pruning improperly can also cut off the flowers. So if they're being pruned after those flower buds formed, which form during the summer, June, July, August, if you prune after that, you're cutting off the flower buds.
Oh.
And then they won't have flowers in the spring.
So when do you recommend pruning?
Well, for the health of the plant, you can prune before they flower. Just don't prune the whole plant so that you're only cutting off some of the stems and leaving the rest to flower. But if you do need to cut the plant back heavily each year, do it right after flowering.
Okay. Well, I don't have to worry about it flowering because they haven't been flowering.
Yeah. So for this year, allow them to leaf out a little bit, then let them grow for this year as much as you can. If you don't think you've been putting on too much manure in the fall, fine, go ahead and put some organic matter around the base. But they don't really need a lot of fertilizer.
Well, they don't.
And then just don't prune them. And the other thing is the lighting. Really examine the lighting that they get, whether they get full sun all the time or not.
They're in full sun all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then it's probably not the light. It's probably pruning.
Okay.
All right, Nancy, good luck to you. Right. Thanks very much. Our guest is Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent, on this edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on this edition of Garden Talk. Happy to have you with us today as we continue with Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent. Let me plug, after the noon news, we'll be talking with Barbara Ellis, a writer, editor, and author of many books, the co-author with Karen Davis Cutler of Burpee, The Complete Flower Gardener. It's published by Wiley. And just out, we'll be talking with Barbara about that book and its contents. Let's go back to the phones now. Let me give you the number in Madison, 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. There is one line open. But let's go to Jim next in Madison. Jim, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. I'm having a problem. I had planted some bee balm a couple of years ago, and last year I got powdery mildew, and it totally destroyed them.
Mm-hmm.
And the bee balm is coming up now. It's just showing its head through the dirt, and I want to prevent that from happening this year.
Yeah, and you do kind of have to get on it as soon as the weather turns warm and humid, because that's what encourages powdery mildew. And bee balm, or Monarda is another name for it, or bergamot, is one of those plants that just is notorious for having powdery mildew. So once the weather does get warm finally, you know, probably late May, early June, there are kind of two methods of controlling. Well, there's actually maybe three or four things you can do. First of all, make sure that the planting is not too dense, too thick, too many stems coming up all together, so that you can get good air circulation through the foliage. That helps, but that's hard to do sometimes. The other thing is to not water them overhead so that you're not getting the leaves wet and allowing those leaves to stay moist and humid long enough for that fungus spores to germinate and then actually penetrate through the leaves. So those are two cultural things that you can kind of do to help prevent or minimize the powdery mildew. Another thing you can do is to dig up all of that bee balm and then look for one of the cultivars that are resistant to powdery mildew. It is resistance. It is not total immunity, but there are cultivars that are less susceptible to it, so you can look for that. But if should you choose to treat it, there are fungicides labeled for powdery mildew on herbaceous perennials, and you would need to make sure that both of those things are on the label, both the powdery mildew and bee balm. And then there's also a combination that's recommended by Extension for powdery mildew that you can kind of mix up yourself. It is made with baking soda and ultra-fine oil, which is an oil that you can formulated specifically for use on plants. You can get that at local garden centers. It is not a dormant oil or a summer oil, really. It's called ultra-fine oil. And most garden centers are carrying that now, or many of them are. And it's that baking soda and oil in water that's sprayed on the plant on a regular basis.
Okay. Yeah, I had seen that recipe online, but it didn't sound like. But the only thing it did say is make sure you get it underneath the leaves, which sometimes is a bit of a problem.
Yeah, but powdery mildew forms more on the top of the leaves, so it's not as important as with some conditions and some insects and stuff to get it under the leaves. It's more important on the top of the leaves, and not to do it all the time so you're adding to the moisture on the leaves that much. You know, I think it's the recommendation something like 7 to 10 days. And I'll tell you where you can find that recommendation through Extension, and that is on the Horticulture Team website, and it is one of our Wisconsin Garden fact sheets. And the Horticulture Team website is wihort.uwex.edu. And then right when that page comes up, you'll see one of the links is for the Wisconsin Garden fact sheets. Click on that, and you'll find the one on powdery mildew.
Great.
All right.
I hope I have better success this
year. Good luck.
Because the bee balm attracts the hummingbirds.
I know.
That's great to see them around.
I know. That's exciting when they come.
Yes.
Thanks very much, Jim. What are some other plants that attract hummingbirds that you might be aware of?
Well, there's trumpet vine, which is kind of a tough one because it grows so fast and so vigorously, but it really is attractive to hummingbirds. And anything with a trumpet-shaped flower, oftentimes things that have kind of a cluster of trumpet-shaped flowers. I believe lantana is one of those plants.
Mm-hmm.
Right off the top of my head, that's all I can come up with, but I know there are a lot of them.
All right. Back to the phones we go. Mike in Milwaukee has a question. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question on hydro seeding.
Yes.
We had built a home last year and hydro seeded in June, and although it filled in fairly nice, it seems to be very thin in a lot of places. I know that I'm told the seeds can lay dormant for some time. Should I did not fertilize in the fall. Should I be fertilizing now? And
yeah. Go ahead.
Or in hopes that the dormant seeds come through, or should I be reseeding?
What type of time of year did you hydroseed? When did you do this? Last fall?
Mike, did we lose you? Oh, I think we lost his cell phone connection.
Okay. Well, it depends on when this was done. The best time to start grass seed, to start a new lawn, and the hydroseeding would be one process to do that, would be the middle of August through the middle of September. If it's done later than that, you'll may get some good growth starting in the fall, and particularly this last year we had a very long, warm fall. But then that growth, because it's so young and tender, may be killed off once cold weather arrives. And as I remember, it was very nice and warm, and then it took maybe a week or so, but we went down quite a bit temperature-wise, and that could have been very difficult on his new planting. So he may have lost some of it from that. As far as that seed remaining dormant, as long as the growing conditions are good for the seed to sprout and grow, it will sprout and grow. And that takes soil temperatures of only about 55 degrees and moisture, constant moisture. There is dormant seeding for lawns, but that's done like in November, and I kind of doubt he was hydro seeding in November.
Before we go any further, what is hydro seeding?
Hydro seeding is where they mix the seed with a medium, of an organic medium, that then they spray it out over the lawn.
Okay.
Or over the area. It holds moisture against the seed, it covers the area very quickly, and it kind of mulches at the same time.
Okay.
Then the other possibility just is that the mixture of grass seed types that they used were not necessarily the hardiest of grass seed types.
Mm-hmm.
And perennial ryegrass is one thing that comes up very quickly and is used in a lot of mixes, but sometimes it's not completely hardy in our area, and especially with the hard, cold winter that we had this year. So it could have been a combination of things. What should he do now? Yeah, if he didn't fertilize last fall, he should probably lightly fertilize this spring, and then fertilize again around Memorial Day, and then again around Labor Day, and then at Halloween. So he's got several fertilizer applications. He also needs to mow that lawn as soon as it starts growing and gets to the normal mowing height. A lot of people think with a new lawn that you should let that seed grow for a long time and get really long before you cut it. But cutting it actually stimulates better rooting. So those are a few things he can do. He can also overseed in the areas that are very thin. And starting grass seed in the spring, early in the spring, is pretty successful, depending on how soon it gets hot.
Our next caller, Sharon, is Barb in Green Bay. Hello, Barb.
Hi. I have a question about a spruce tree in my yard. It's probably 40 years old, probably 40 feet tall, and it looks pretty good. Some of the lower branches were a little beat up, and we took those off. But now we are losing whole branches that are just kind of breaking off close to the trunk and just falling to the ground, and they're green. And they look healthy, and I'm just wondering what's going on.
Oh, my, me too. That's quite unusual for them to just break off and fall off. And they're
really?
Green?
They're green.
Otherwise healthy-looking branches?
They look good. Oh, and we had heavy snow here a few weeks ago, and we lost four at that time.
Okay.
And another one came down a week ago. And unfortunately...
All on its own?
They're green. They look perfectly healthy, and they just break off and fall down.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm just wondering if the whole tree is weak. It's kind of close to the lot line, and unfortunately, most of this is falling next door.
I'm sure they're not happy about that.
Probably not.
Probably not, but you don't want to lose a 40-foot tree, that's
I
for sure.
I don't. The birds love it. And
is it growing in full sun?
Yes and no. There are spruce trees on either side of it, so
okay.
Two sides of it are not getting full sun, but the rest of it is.
Okay.
East and west sides are getting full sun.
And so the two that are growing on the other sides of it, are they doing all right, or are they dropping branches too?
They're not dropping branches. They're good on the sides where they're not touching that other tree, you know, where the three trees meet, they're all kind of a little bare where they meet.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, they look okay.
Well, spruce trees can shade each other's their own and each other's lower branches out sometimes too, but that, I wouldn't expect they usually lose their needles when they're shaded out, not losing whole green branches. Examine those branches that have fallen off, if you still have more with the next one that falls off, and look at the point where it was attached to the tree and where it falls off, and see if you notice any evidence of it having been chewed or anything. You know, it sometimes amazes me what squirrels can do to a tree for just it's odd reasons. I mean, no particular reason. It's not like a typical behavior that they will gnaw off a branch, but they occasionally do for some reason. So that's something to look for. You probably see some little teeth marks or something. Or is it coming off real jagged? Does it look rotted there? Are there holes into the bark or into the wood on the branch that came off or at the point where it was attached to the tree? So really do some sleuthing. Look very carefully and make some careful observations.
Barb, thanks very much for your call and good luck to you and that tree. Sharon, I got to break in because we're going to have to run for the news, and it's just been a pleasure to have you with us again.
Very good. My pleasure, too. Thank you very much.
We look forward to your appearances. Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent. I'm Jim Packard. Our thanks to Carmen Jackson for on-air phone production today. And we'll be talking more in just a few minutes about growing a flower garden organically here on the Ideas Network.